From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, House Speaker Paul Ryan says he has questions after NPR revealed that while in the Air Force, the church shooter in Texas was court-martialed and imprisoned for assaulting his wife and fracturing his infant stepson's skull.
We have laws in the books that says if you're a domestic abuser, you're not supposed to own a gun. He was a domestic abuser. That's why we got all these questions with the Air Force right now, which is how did this get slipped through the cracks?
Well, for one thing, the domestic assault in 2012 was not communicated by the Air Force to the system of background checks that would have prevented him from buying his guns, the assault-style rifle, and two guns he used in the attack. NPR's Camila Domonoske has been following this story. And Camila, you say the information that the Air Force had was not uploaded into the federal crime database. Is that how it works? It's automatic? Tell us more.
It's not an automatic system. At some point, you do have a person who needs to put this information into the database that the FBI has available for this purpose. And in this case, the shooter's conviction, his court-martial, disqualified him from gun ownership for two separate reasons. First of all, the crime of assault that he was convicted of, it was punishable by up to 5 years of confinement, the military equivalent of jail time. And he was only actually sentenced to 1 year, but the fact that it was punishable by 5 years meant that it qualified. It should have made him not eligible for gun ownership or gun possession. And the second reason is that the nature of his crime was domestic violence. He fractured his stepson's skull and assaulted his then wife. Based on those two reasons, this actually should have gone into the system both before his conviction, when there was probable cause that he committed these crimes, and after he was actually convicted, but it never went in.
And it's being called a clerical problem that it didn't go into the system. But you say even if it had gone in, been uploaded, there's this language problem between the military and civilian systems. If the military had called it, as the military does, assault instead of domestic violence, it might not have triggered that part of the law. And if it had only said a year, because he plea bargained down to a year, the language of the law, as we understand it, the civilian law, says a crime punishable by imprisonment for more than 1 year. So if they didn't know it was plea bargained down from 5 to 1, that wouldn't have been caught either.
Yeah, I spoke with the former chief prosecutor for the Air Force who was there at the time that this court-martial happened, and he said that it is very possible for things to be lost in translation between the military and the civilian judicial systems just because they have different terminologies, and that's even when the military is sharing information. And again, what appears to have happened here was an error at this Air Force base in New Mexico where the information was never input at all. And I should say the Air Force said last night they're conducting an internal review of what happened here and of other similar cases to determine if there's more information that should have been passed along. And the Pentagon is looking at other branches of the military as well.
Well, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand tweeted out, "No excuse for this. I'm calling on the Department of Defense to audit old case files to prevent this deadly error from happening again." But one wonders, I mean, what can they do? Can they go then trace people who should have had this kind of language uploaded and maybe didn't and take weapons away? It seems kind of unwieldy. So what is the military saying they'll do if they find that this has happened before?
At this point, they're focusing on the fact that they are launching an investigation, that they're trying to evaluate the scope of the problem. And I will say we do have some information that there might be other cases that would fall under the similar situation as this one. We don't know for sure. Again, an investigation has been launched. It's ongoing. But we do know that currently the vast majority of the instances that the military does report into this database as flagging someone as ineligible for gun ownership is based on whether or not they got a dishonorable discharge, which is not the same as what happened in this case.
Well, yeah, tell us about that, because, again, in the civilian law, a dishonorable discharge prohibits someone from buying a gun. A bad conduct discharge doesn't. This shooter got a bad conduct discharge. What's the difference, and why isn't it dishonorable to fracture a child's skull?
Well, they're both punitive discharges from the military that are only in response to someone being convicted of having done something wrong in the eyes of the military, which can include a number of different things. In the case of a dishonorable discharge, that's for extremely egregious behavior as determined by the court-martial members, sort of like a jury. Based on the shooter's crimes here, he would have been eligible for being punished with a dishonorable discharge, but the group of people who are making the decision opted to give him a bad conduct discharge. That means that based on the nature of his discharge, he's not inherently banned from owning a gun, but again, the nature of the crime for which he was convicted, that got him.
Camila Domonoske, NPR reporter, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
President Trump is in South Korea today on his five-nation Asian tour. Trump met with the South Korean President Moon Jae-in, and the two agreed to cooperate on strengthening South Korea's defense capabilities. Meanwhile, there were protests in Seoul today, protesters holding signs reading, "Trump not welcome." The president arrives in China tomorrow for meetings with President Xi Jinping, and NPR's Rob Schmitz is in Shanghai. Rob, how is President Trump's visit playing in Chinese media?
I think that the Chinese media is looking really closely at what he's saying about North Korea, because this is going to be at the top of his agenda when Trump arrives to Beijing. And so I think that they're anticipating a good summit with him, but they're also a little worried about a couple of things. I think that Trump is going to talk about North Korea quite a bit when he comes to Beijing, but he's also going to talk about trade, which is sort of a sticking point between the U.S. and China.
Well, let's talk about North Korea first. Is the president likely to be able to get China to do what he wants China to do on the issue of North Korea because of this visit?
Well, you know, China's already done quite a bit when it comes to North Korea. And that's a lot of that's based on the sanctions that the UN Security Council has placed on North Korea. You know, China's been complying with those sanctions. And, you know, we've seen some pretty major moves from China when it comes to trade. You know, North Korea relies on China for 90% of its trade, and China has limited its imports of coal from North Korea. It's down 70% from last year. And they've also significantly limited their exports of oil to North Korea, which is a big hit to Pyongyang, since the North relies on China for nearly all of its oil. So China's done quite a bit with regards to energy and things like that that can really hit Pyongyang pretty hard.
But they haven't done as much as President Trump would like, it sounds like. Do you think that he'll get any more concessions?
No, I don't. I don't think they're going to get much more from China at this stage. You know, it's possible that China will say, oh, yes, we'll keep limiting this or that. But I think, you know, China is worried that if it does much more, that it will lead to a destabilization of the regime in Pyongyang. And that's exactly what China does not want.
What about on the issue of trade, not between China and North Korea, but between China and the U.S. or other countries in the region in the U.S.? You say that that's going to be a big topic of conversation on President Trump's visit.
Yeah, and I think we should look at trade as a sticking point at which I think that China could actually hopefully make some changes and structural changes in this relationship, because China is simply not a level playing field for U.S. businesses. And when I talk to businesses here, and I was in Beijing last week, I always hear this word, reciprocity. You know, the U.S. has been open to China, but China has been increasingly closed to the U.S. And there's a hope among executives here that Trump will need to equalize that relationship in order to call this trip a true success. Because, you know, he's going to come, you're going to see a lot of executives surrounding him. There's going to be a lot of deals that are made, especially in energy. But I think what we really need to look for are these structural changes in the trading relationship between the U.S. and China.
What does President Xi want most out of this visit?
That's a really good question. I think that Xi Jinping wants to look strong because, you know, this type of visit for him is important. He's always thinking about what his own base, you know, the Chinese people are seeing, you know, when they're watching this. He's going to want to look like he's not giving too much up to President Trump. He's going to want to look strong. He's going to take the first place that Trump is going to go to when he gets here is the Forbidden City. So, you know, Xi Jinping is taking him to sort of the traditional seat of power in the capital city. And I think that that's his deal. You know, that he's always wanting to look like he's in control, he's in charge, and he's a powerful leader.
Rob, you've been living in China for many years now. Where would you take President Trump if you wanted to show him something that he wouldn't be able to find on his own?
Well, if I were Xi Jinping, I think I would probably take President Trump to see a high-speed rail line here in China. You know, in the last 10 years, China has built the largest high-speed rail network in the world. These trains go, you know, more than 200 miles an hour. The distance between Beijing and Shanghai now has been reduced to 4.5 hours from something like 18 hours many years ago. It is truly incredible. And the pace of change of China, I think, is really symbolized by that network that has been built so quickly and so well.
That's NPR Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz. President Trump will head to China tomorrow. Rob, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Voters in many communities across the country are going to the polls today. Maine voters will weigh whether to expand Medicaid as part of the Affordable Care Act. In Ohio, voters are considering a measure to limit the price of prescription drugs purchased by the state. There are mayoral races in many cities and governor's races in two states, Virginia and New Jersey. Joining us now by Skype is Larry Sabato, director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. Larry, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
And let's start with the race for governor in Virginia. This is the Republican Ed Gillespie, who was a former Republican National Committee chair, against Democratic Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam. Both are seeking to replace Governor Terry McAuliffe, who cannot seek a second term. How tight is that race?
It's tighter than people expected. This, remember, is the only southern state that Hillary Clinton carried.
Right.
One would expect a Democrat, particularly with Donald Trump in the White House and being as unpopular as he is in Virginia and across the nation, one would expect the Democrat to be a substantial favorite. I think he is the favorite, but it's also true that Gillespie has upset potential. He nearly was elected to the Senate in a near upset back in 2014.
How much of the race is about Trump?
A great deal of it. No way to deny that. And neither side does privately. Gillespie is really an establishment Republican. He worked in the Bush White House. It's pretty clear that Trump was not his choice to be the Republican nominee last year. But he realizes he couldn't possibly win without exciting the Trump forces here in Virginia and getting a large turnout. So he did something very interesting. He kept Trump at arm's length personally. Trump is the first president not to campaign in Virginia since a Watergate burden Nixon in 1973. At the same time, he ran on Trump issues like crime and immigration, Confederate monuments, social issues.
Well, and President Trump has stepped into the race, at least by Twitter, and he's been talking about the fact that Virginia is doing very poorly economically, even though it's got a very low unemployment rate right now.
The tweet is completely inaccurate. It simply is not true, but no doubt many thousands will believe it.
Well, and is the economy a key issue in this race?
The economy is always important in any race, but the economy in most places in Virginia, and certainly in the urban corridor, is quite strong. So I don't think that cuts against the incumbent party at all. And in fact, the incumbent governor, Terry McAuliffe, is reasonably popular. That also helps his successor to be potentially Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam.
What about the race in New Jersey? Voters are looking to replace Republican Governor Chris Christie, who's got very low approval ratings there and cannot seek a third term. In this case, it's Republican Lieutenant Governor Kim Guadagno versus the Democratic former Goldman Sachs executive Phil Murphy. What's notable about this race?
What's notable about it is that it's barely a race at all. It's one-sided from everything we can see, all the objective data at least. And that makes sense. New Jersey is a blue state, pretty deeply blue in most elections. And as you mentioned, Chris Christie, the incumbent Republican governor, a two-termer, has very low approval ratings. With Donald Trump in the White House added on top, it just becomes nearly impossible for another Republican to win. So I think Murphy is expected to win handily.
How high are the stakes for Democrats in both of these elections?
They're very high, and it's easy to exaggerate off-year elections. We always do it, and I guarantee you we'll do it tonight and tomorrow because we've been desperate for election data. But the truth is that Democrats have to show they can bounce back from their unexpected defeat with Hillary Clinton last November. This gives them the opportunity, not so much in New Jersey as in Virginia. Democrats have to ask, if they can't win in Virginia, the only southern state Hillary Clinton carried, then when can they win and where can they win in 2018? They're counting on a victory, and they're going to be very demoralized if they don't get one.
Well, and unlike some of the other special elections that we've seen since Election Day 2016, these are both in states that Hillary Clinton won. These are both in blue states.
That is correct. And Democrats are at such a low point nationally in governorships, the lowest since the early 1920s, just 15. This gives them the opportunity to start rebuilding. And again, if they can't rebuild in blue states, how are they going to win red states or purple competitive states?
So it's election day today, and an election day that some people have voted in, not everybody. I was at the polls this morning and it was kind of empty. But a year from now, it'll probably be a lot busier when we see the midterm elections and the elections in the House and the Senate. Larry Sabato, look into your crystal ball. What do you think is going to happen 1 year from now?
In the House of Representatives, it will be a big surprise if Democrats don't pick up seats. The only question is whether they can get 24 or more and actually take over the House. And it's tough because of the lines drawn with gerrymandering. In the Senate, the odds are stacked heavily in favor of the Republicans because of the seats that are up. Democrats will do well just to hold their 48 seats. So it probably will be a mixed result, but if we're surprised, it's going to be that Democrats do better than expected. Now, that's pending two victories tonight in New Jersey and Virginia.
That's Larry Sabato, director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. Larry, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Clevelanders are choosing the next mayor of their city. Both candidates are African American, no one surprised. It was a different story 50 years ago when Carl Stokes became the first black man to be elected mayor of any major American city. That achievement was celebrated in a little-known, recently discovered album. David C. Burnett from WCPN IdeaStream has this story.
A jazz orchestra and a string quartet sit ready to play as a man steps up to the microphone. Carl Stokes, mayor of Cleveland, starts to read a poem by another noted Clevelander, Langston Hughes.
I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh.
Behind the control room glass was famed New York jazz producer Bob Thiel. Next to him was noted composer and arranger Oliver Nelson. They'd collaborated on a series of recordings like this. Each one featured prominent American cultural voices commenting on current issues over a jazz soundtrack.
Take this hammer, and carry it to the captain. You tell him I'm gone. Tell him I'm gone.
Music historian Lauren Schoenberg says the albums were released on Thiel's personal label, and they definitely weren't headed for the top of the pop charts.
At that time, you had people who were making enough money from the commercial stuff that felt that they could go out and record things that they loved. There may not have been a huge payday at the end.
The Stokes recording was released under the title The Mayor and the People. On one side of the record, he can be heard reciting a mixture of gospel lyrics and verse from poets like Langston Hughes and Gil Scott-Heron.
Picture a man of nearly 30 who seems twice as old with clothes torn and dirty.
The other side consisted of an impromptu question-and-answer session from an invited audience arranged by Thiel.
Well, see, that's a very easy statement.
Now, just a minute. Now, are we going to be able to... am I going to be able to answer your questions?
Are you going to say anything? It's a question.
In one exchange, Stokes called for young radicals to work within the democratic system.
That you can't beat the system by violence. You're talking about a country that's got the Army, the Navy, the Coast Guard, the CIA. What do you know what would happen if they turn on an identifiable minority group in this country? Why, they'd wipe you out and... it would not be inconsistent with history. it would not be inconsistent.
41-year-old Johnny Parker wasn't even born when Carl Stokes was elected mayor, but Parker says he's grown up with the Stokes legacy.
Carl Stokes has always kind of been present in our family as inspirational. That kind of dogged toughness of, let's go after it, let's get it, let's be about the business of affecting change.
Parker was co-director of a recent concert featuring music from the Stokes recording, performed by a combination of Cleveland gospel and jazz performers.
It's the Stokes Legacy Jazz Orchestra.
Trumpeter Dominic Farinacci collaborated with Parker on the project.
That concept of bringing the music and current events together, I think, is very important right now for our culture. The country is so divided in many ways on many fronts, and arts and music is always a pathway to empathy. It's very powerful.
Take this hammer, and carry it to the captain.
Oliver Nelson Jr. attended the performance and was happy to hear his father's music performed live for the first time. He noted that the poetry readings from 40 years ago sounded very relevant today.
The names have changed. The Black Panther Party is no longer around, but Black Lives Matter is around, and we're still fighting the same battles.
Johnny Parker says those long-fought battles and the fact that we're still debating the best way to address police-community relations might be discouraging to some. He finds them inspiring, just like reviving an old, forgotten recording that still has a powerful message.
If you're talking about it, you have to think that there's some hope.
The evening ended with all the musicians, jazz and gospel alike, playing and singing together. It brought a smile to Dominic Farinacci's face.
I think for whatever reason, we don't all play together all that much, you know? Even though Cleveland is a small town, we're kind of in our own separate areas of the city. I think we all have a lot to learn from each other.
Maybe that's an idea whose time has come in Cleveland and the rest of the country. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett. Comes from you. It comes
from you. In Cambodia, Prime Minister Hun Sen's crackdown on dissent continues. The Supreme Court there has denied bail to an opposition leader who's accused of treason. And the court also set a date to hear a motion that would dissolve the main opposition party altogether ahead of elections next year. Michael Sullivan reports from Phnom Penh.
Good luck finding an opposition lawmaker in Phnom Penh willing to talk these days.
Yeah, they are afraid. They are afraid.
And with good reason, says political analyst Mies Nhi, who reckons about half the Cambodian National Rescue Party MPs have fled since their leader, Kham Sok Kha, was arrested back in September.
Some, they have their name in the blacklist of the government, so they deserve to be fearful and have to leave the country, you know.
Mies Nhi says the government crackdown, the surveillance, is the worst he's seen in more than a decade.
On the street or in the coffee shop, we've been experiencing that our phone conversation have been tapped and recorded or sometimes widely disseminated through media.
The CNRP almost won the last election, something the government clearly wasn't going to allow this time around. In the past few months, it's pulled the plug on at least a dozen radio stations broadcasting programs from the Voice of America and Radio Free Asia, and hounded the English-language Cambodia Daily out of business over a tax bill. Then came the treason charge. Prime Minister Hun Sen used this 2013 speech of Kham Sok Kha in Australia to accuse the opposition leader and his party of plotting to topple the government with help from the U.S., charges Kham Sok Kha vehemently denies. Hun Sen has also asked the Supreme Court to dissolve Kham Sok Kha's party outright.
We need political order, respect our law, instead of a puppet from foreign interests to stir up Cambodian political situation.
That's government spokesman Pai Sipan, who says the decision to ban the CNRP is up to the court, but he adds,
they have to go.
And if they do go, the Election Commission is set to give most of the CNRP seats to a small party once bitterly opposed to Hun Sen.
Of course, we are happy.
Hun Sen's one-time rival and former Prime Minister Prince Norodom Ranarid of the suddenly relevant Funcinpec Party.
We have no choice. We have only two. Either we will oppose without end, or we have to do what we have to do to serve the people of Cambodia.
In this game of divide and conquer, Hun Sen appears to have already won.
I believe Mr. Prime Minister to be one smart politician. He's definitely a survivor. He's definitely know how to rule. He's definitely know how to stay.
That's Viraku, who heads the Phnom Penh think tank Future Forum. Other analysts think Hun Sen may have also calculated Cambodia isn't as dependent on the West as it used to be, with a new friend, China, whose economic assistance comes without conditions about pesky issues like human rights. Government spokesman Pai Sipan.
China is, give us opportunity to protect our sovereignty, to protect our economic growth.
Opposition lawmaker Ma Monivan is one of the only CNRP members still speaking out. He hopes the U.S. and the European Union will be able to pressure Hun Sen to ease up or risk economic sanctions. Ma Monivan also says he's staying. If you want a democratic country, no one's going to hand it to you on a plate, he says. You have to fight for it. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Phnom Penh.
Let's get back to our top story, the shooting in Sutherland Springs, Texas, which left 26 people dead. Residents in the small town are trying to absorb what happened. Joey Palacios from Texas Public Radio reports.
Jesus, thank you, Jesus.
Sutherland Springs is full of prayer this week. Yesterday afternoon, people gathered across the street from the First Baptist Church to mourn the dead, lost friends, family, and neighbors. Sherry Pomeroy's husband, Frank, is pastor of First Baptist. Sherry says churchgoers shared their lives every week.
Our church was not comprised of members or parishioners. We were a very close family. We ate together, we laughed together, we cried together, and we worshiped together. Now most of our church family is gone. Our building is probably beyond repair.
The Pomeroys weren't at the church during Sunday's shooting, but their 14-year-old daughter, Annabelle, was. She was killed.
News media have been bombarding us with requests to share and comment and appear to celebrate Annabelle's life. However, as much tragedy as that entails for our family, we don't want to overshadow the other lives lost yesterday.
Entire families were ripped apart Sunday. Over a dozen of the victims were children. Some died, others are recovering. Amber Main usually attends First Baptist, but she didn't last weekend. She says she lost many people close to her.
As far as I know, there's my youth pastor and her husband, one of my very close family friends who was pregnant at the time. Two little kids I know that I helped take care of, and somebody that was there for me through everything.
Among those main mentions is Crystal Holcomb, who was 8 months pregnant. Crystal was one of eight members of the Holcomb family, spanning three generations, who died in the mass shooting. For Sutherland Springs residents like Jim Crossley, it seems almost unreal.
She was a good lady. All of them are. They were good folks. They worked hard for their living. They took care of their kids. And they made sure that they were all, you know, fed and taken care of the way they should be. They're good folks.
Crossley's mourning his family friend, Joanne Ward. Two of her children are also dead, Emily and Brooke, ages 7 and 5. He says Joanne was too young for this, just 30 years old.
I'm still trying to get it through my head why somebody would have to come down here and destroy somebody's lives like they did.
Lorenzo Flores knew Joanne Ward for more than 27 years.
Joanne lived in my neighborhood when she was a little girl. She went to school with my boys. So I saw her grow up. She was like a daughter to me, you know?
Flores and his girlfriend Terry run a taco shop inside a convenience store near First Baptist Church called Teresa's Kitchen. Flores says he saw Joanne Ward all the time.
It's like he took a piece of my life, you know, because I've known her so long. She was a part of my family.
In a small Texas town like Sutherland Springs, that feeling is everywhere today. Flores and others say it'll take time to return to normal, and it will likely never be the same. Sunday's shooting has left a scar in South Texas. People here will try to mend their wounds with faith, prayer, and support for one another. For Here and Now, I'm Joey Palacios.
Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has accused Iran of direct military aggression by arming rebels in Yemen with missiles. One of those missiles was intercepted on its way to Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh, on Saturday. After that, Saudi Arabia jailed many members of the Saudi royal family. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is also accusing Lebanon of declaring war against it because of aggression by the Iran-backed Lebanese Shiite group Hezbollah. We're joined by Aaron David Miller, Middle East Program Director at the Wilson Center. Aaron David Miller, welcome back.
Always a pleasure to be here.
And with all of these pieces of news coming from the region, is this at its core about Iran versus Saudi Arabia?
It is on the external side. There's no question about it. These three pieces that we've seen, the purges, confrontation and tension between Yemen and Saudi Arabia, and most recently Saudi pressure on Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri to resign, are all part of a broader regional struggle for influence control between Tehran and Riyadh. But there's a subtext to this that is critically important, and that is the ascent of Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, youngest son of the current king of Saudi Arabia, who has mounted what is tantamount to an extraordinary bid for absolute power in Saudi Arabia in a way that is quite extraordinary with respect to how other Middle Eastern leaders have behaved, and certainly by Saudi standards. This young man, if Saudi Arabia survives, could well be king of the kingdom for 50 years. That's an extraordinary fact and gives him a fair amount of time and space hopefully, to grow into his role.
And President Trump weighed in on Saudi Arabia's King Salman and the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for the purge of the princes and top officials who were arrested and detained over the weekend. The president tweeted, "I have great confidence in King Salman and the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. They know exactly what they're doing. Some of those they are harshly treating have been milking their country for years." What do you make of the U.S. response there?
Well, what I make is that perhaps the most significant achievement of MBS and his father, King Salman, has been to cast a spell over the Trump administration, an administration that is banking heavily on Saudi Arabia, not only to engage with it in an effort to contain and roll back Iran, but perhaps even to deliver on what may well be the undeliverable, which is the president's notion of an ultimate deal between Israelis and Palestinians. I mean, forget the fact that enabling authoritarians is to the advantage of the United States, which it clearly isn't. This president has invested heavily in a young man whose conduct abroad in Yemen, in Qatar, and now I suspect in Lebanon is only going to increase, it seems to me, tensions, and in some respects, we are far too closely associated with him and his policies.
Well, what are the risks to the U.S. of being so closely associated there?
Well, first of all, you've got the disastrous and protracted war in Yemen, which has now gone on for several years, a country that was already a failing state, if not failed state. Terrible outbreak of cholera, significant famine and hunger, and a tremendous amount of civilian casualties caused by Saudi airstrikes, which we are enabling both with respect to our intelligence assets and to refueling and strategy. The campaign against Qatar has divided the Gulf Cooperation Council and, frankly, isn't working. And the president has weighed in on that one, reflecting, I suspect, unlike Secretary of State Tillerson, doesn't appear to have much influence with the president's own bias in favor of Saudi Arabia. There hasn't been much comment on Lebanon, but the Saudis are playing with fire. I have no brief here for Iran or Hezbollah, but the reality is the Saudis are unable to protect the Lebanese from the tensions and crisis that could develop as a consequence of pressure on the Lebanese prime minister to step aside.
One more thing I want to ask you about. While all this is going on between Iran and Saudi Arabia, there's also been news out of Iraq where the Iraqi government and the Kurds have been fighting over territory. The Kurds want independence. Is that connected in any way to what's going on?
You know, I think the Saudis are sensible enough to recognize that getting involved in a major proxy war in Iraq is beyond their capacity to influence. No, this is a consequence of the anomalies and contradictions of Iraqi politics, which ultimately is going to affect our notion of a unified, cohesive, and sectarian co-opted Iraq. It's a problem for us as well.
That's Aaron David Miller, a Middle East program director at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. Aaron David Miller, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We will no doubt learn more from the more than 13 million leaked documents called the Paradise Papers. But right now, they're shedding light on trillions of dollars, including from the world's most profitable company, Apple, moving through offshore tax havens. And there are other revelations that appear to link investments in Twitter and Facebook to Russian government-controlled companies. Let's find out more from our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Johanna Buya is senior editor at Recode. Hi, Johanna.
Hi, how's it going?
It's good. So for years, Apple has faced questions about using tax-friendly Ireland to sidestep taxes. There was that crackdown in 2013. What do these Paradise Papers tell us now about Apple?
Right. So after the U.S. Senate basically struck down Apple or reprimanded them for shifting their profits to the Irish subsidiary, the EU followed suit and ordered them to pay 13 billion euro in back taxes, following which the Paradise Papers revealed that the company started shopping around for a new tax haven and eventually landed on a small island of Jersey in the English Channel. It's not necessarily illegal to do that, and Apple has said that they've spoken to all of the concerning government parties and that they're not paying any fewer taxes, but they did find a nice new island to headquarter their business.
Right, and avoid some taxes. And you say this isn't illegal, but there are moral questions. One estimate is that the tax structure that they had could have cost governments $240 billion a year in revenue. Has Apple responded to that? What do they say about what they pay?
That was a 2015 survey that you're citing. And it wasn't just Apple. It was, any company that uses that tax structure could cost a number of governments $240 billion a year in revenue. Apple has said, they've reached out to all of the concerning parties and they are not paying any fewer taxes on their profits than they had been in the past.
Yeah,
so that's their response.
Well, so they say that they remain the world's largest taxpayer. I think, am I reading this correctly, about $35 billion in corporate tax over the past 3 years. And that this move, the changes, didn't reduce our tax payments in any country. So that's their response there. But do you think there will be more questions?
I think certainly the Paradise Papers, this was not the largest revelation in the many, thousands of documents, but it does beg a lot of questions just given that, Apple had only recently faced scrutiny from the EU.
Well, meanwhile, you've been reporting on major investments in Facebook and Twitter with ties to Russian government-owned companies. Tell us more.
So Yuri Milner, he is a Russian billionaire who co-founded a venture capital firm called DST Global, which in turn invested in Facebook and Twitter and obtained a large stake in both companies before they IPO'd and went public. We didn't really know who funded those investments until the Paradise Papers, which revealed that Russian-owned banks, I think it's VTB Bank and an energy corporation called Gazprom, helped fund DST Global's investment in Facebook and Twitter. Facebook obviously, emphasizes that, one, DST Global has sold its stakes in the company, but even while DST Global was an investor, they didn't have a board seat and they didn't have voting rights. And so, Yuri Milner has come out with an open letter saying that, any any implication that he used his investment in Facebook and Twitter to wield power over the social media platforms is a fairy tale, in his words. And he's saying that he's sort of fallen a victim to the negative connotations of any links to Russia.
Well, sure. But superficially, you could say, wow, this Kremlin-tied Russian billionaire invested in these platforms so that then perhaps Russia could use these platforms to influence the 2016 presidential election. And we know both companies are facing federal investigations in how Russian agents did use the platforms. Now, Facebook, Twitter aren't government agencies. Are there some legal problems potentially here?
Well, I think that it's really important to note that in the documents, there was no indication that, you know, Yuri Milner or DST Global used their investment to influence Facebook and Twitter, or there's really no – I mean, both Facebook and Twitter, and as well as Yuri Milner, point out that he sold his shares in the company well before the 2016 presidential election. Of course, it's not illegal to get funding from foreign funds. But, you know, it does come at a time where we're really questioning how much influence the Russian government had over these platforms.
Well, Johanna, we have about a minute here, but we want to ask you about another story. Uber, struggling with scandals and boycotts, has seen its U.S. sales bounce back. How much of a dip did Uber see, and were you surprised to see it come back?
Yeah, it's interesting. So Uber, for the first time ever, as a result of its public scandals, lost a good deal of market share to Lyft and ceded some ground to Lyft. Originally, they had 84% of the market around that, depending on which surveys you're looking at, and now only have 73% of the U.S. market. But its sales, on the other hand, in some of the markets where it saw the biggest dip, for instance, San Francisco, New York, Portland, its sales have now recovered. So they still, you know, Lyft still has a good hold on its portion of the market, which is 22% in most places or across the U.S. But the Uber is seeing the same level of bookings that it did before then.
I'll leave it at that. Johanna Bouya, senior editor at Recode. Thank you.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.